We'll call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order. The hour of 10:15 having arrived, February 8th, 2011. Our first bill today will be a bill from Representative Coonan, House File 18. And Representative Coonan, if you could go to the table there. And what we will do, members, is once we have a quorum, we will officially call the meeting to order. I believe that all the bills today will be having full hearings on, but there will be no votes. These will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Representative Coonan, welcome to your committee. As soon as we have a quorum, we will have you move your bill and get before us. But if you could please present your bill, and then just kind of for a lay of the land here, how many folks, Representative Coonan, do you have to testify for the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have anybody lined up.
Anybody testify against the bill? You haven't lined up testimony against your bill?
Oh. I haven't. Mr. Okay.
He's a veteran. He knows how to do it here. Okay. So there's nobody testify for or against the bill from the audience that we know of? Okay. Please present your bill, Representative Coonan.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House File 15 is a military pension exemption bill. It allows a subtraction for military pay, and this bill allows that subtraction for up to the first $6,000 of retirement benefit. Senator Kubley and I are working on this bill, and we decided to bring it up to that $6,000 level and cap it there because of the concerns we have with the budget deficit. I think, for myself, I would like to see that exemption go further than that, in fact, to a complete exemption at some point in time in the future, but for now, that's the way the bill is drafted.
Okay, excuse me, Representative Coonan. We'll officially call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order. We have a quorum. Representative Lincheski moves the minutes of February 2nd. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The Lincheski motion passes. Representative Coonan moves House File 15. We'll be moving that it's laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Please continue with your bill.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The bill also includes survivor benefit plan payments so that the survivors of military personnel also would get the benefit of the subtraction. This begins in tax year 2011, so it begins right away. And also the subtraction will apply to the alternative minimum tax also. So if you look at the bill, the subtraction applies to Section 1 and Section 2 for the alternative minimum tax. Full-time military, those serving 20 years, would get start receiving their benefit right away after retirement. For National Guard, and when I say benefit, I'm talking about the retirement benefit. For National Guard and other reserve components that are eligible for retirement benefit, they start receiving that at age 60, so there's a little bit of difference there. On some occasions, the Department of Defense will offer an early retirement. That would be for some military members who haven't served 20 years, but that's on a case-by-case basis. There is a cost to the bill, $6.4 million for fiscal year 2012, $6.7 million for fiscal year 2013. The reasons for the bill, first of all, it's the right thing to do, I believe, for veterans. And then secondly, of course, for some of those military retirees that start receiving their pension right after their 20 years of service, they're still in the useful, productive part of their lives and would be looking for other work, and possibly could be individuals that would start new businesses or join existing businesses. And I think it would be a good incentive to, if Minnesota would do this, a good incentive for these military personnel to move to Minnesota. It would put Minnesota on in a more competitive basis with other states who actually do have this exemption. At this point in time, it looks like there would be about 16,700 taxpayers affected that would be affected by the language in this bill. So, Mr. Chairman and committee, that's the bill.
Okay, any questions? We have Representative Bisgins and Erickson.
Thank you, Mr.
Bisgins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Coonan, you mentioned that it put us in line with other states that allow this exemption. Do you have any details, any information on what other states do?
Representative Coonan.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bisgins, there's different variations around the country, but there are some states that exempt all of it. And in fact, if you get to it, there are some states that don't that exempt all pensions, no matter where they come from, but there are also others that exempt the military. And I can't read it offhand, give you which states or how many, but there is quite a difference around the country between what happens in each state.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, I thought I had seen a breakdown and analysis of this from NCSL once upon a time, so you may want to look to find that. And I think it was a big chart on what all 50 states do as it pertains. Okay. And if my recollection serves me correctly, we are in the very small minority that give no breaks to retired military citizens living within our borders. Representative, do you have any information on how many potential Minnesotans we are leaving because they don't have any tax benefits on the retirement? I mean, is there any information that says, you know, we would have more retired military citizens, productive citizens living in the state of Minnesota if we were to offer them some financial incentives? Do you have any information on that?
Representative Coonan?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bisgins, again, I don't have, you know, numbers to give you, but I do know of instances of talking to parents of military personnel who say that their sons and daughters are getting ready to retire, and they're trying to decide where to live, and they actually do look at this and try and figure out where they want to live. And with military personnel, too, it's important to remember that because of their career in the military, they've lived in different parts of the country or even the world, so they're not necessarily tied to a single area. That's not to say there aren't instances where some want to come home no matter what, but that's not all of them by any means. And so, yeah, it's something that does get looked at. And another thing that I should mention, too, is that I know that of some instances of people who also are receiving military pension who actually did move back to Minnesota, have jobs here, and now are looking for a place to retire, too. And so now they're, again, since they have a freedom to move, we'll be looking at that. And this isn't so much for the jobs or employment, but it's where they're going to spend their money from this point forward. And I think it would be nice if they would, you know, if in the cases that are possible, that they'd stay here and spend the retirement money in Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Coonan, and this is a difficult question, but maybe we could find the answer. Do we know how many National Guard members who've been deployed and have chosen to stay in the military so they could retire at 60, conceivably, and on top of that, active, who have been deployed and now returned, or maybe have been deployed a number of times, but have decided to stay in the military and will retire after 20 years, so that we can look into the future to see what we should do in Minnesota to ensure that those stay in Minnesota, those families, those military personnel? Do you have any idea what those numbers are?
Representative Coonan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sure this is all projections, and I don't have the numbers, but if you look at the revenue estimate, they make some projections
right
there, too, and they
right
explain how they do it. Again, I'm sure there are different organizations that have done these kind of projections, but I guess that's the best answer I can give you right at this time. I don't know if there's anybody else here who would have some of those projections work out, but
Mr. Chair, maybe if there's someone from the military affairs and the National Guard, they could provide us with that, just so that we can see into the future, because we've had so many more of our young men and women enlist and join the National Guard, and I think we want to look into the future to see that you know, this is going to be beneficial for keeping them here in our state, and a way to honor them too for their service. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Okay, with that, unless there's other questions, we will lay this.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Coonan.
I don't know if Ms. Manzi can help us a little bit with some of that or not either.
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Coonan, which part of it were you looking for help on?
Representative Coonan?
Actually, a little bit on Representative Biskin's question and Representative Erickson's questions on some of those numbers on what we could expect for a benefit.
Ms. Manzi?
I know that's kind of a pretty general question, but...
Mr. Chair, Representative Coonan, and members of the committee, I do periodically review other states' income tax returns to see how other states treat military retirement pay in their income tax. And I have a file memo on that subject, which I can share with you and members of the committee. Just to give a snapshot of it, there are 9 states that don't have a general income tax. There are 13 states that fully exclude military retirement income from taxable income, either through a specific military retirement exclusion, a government pension exclusion that includes military retirement income, or a general pension exclusion. So that's 13 that exclude it fully and 9 that don't have an income tax. Then there are another 18 that exclude a fixed amount of military retirement income, as Representative Coonan's bill would do. Some of those states limit the exclusion to taxpayers who are over a certain age. And those exclusions, some of them apply specifically to military retirement income, others apply more generally to government pension income, and others apply to all retirement income. There are several other states, 3 states including Minnesota, that have a credit for military retirement income. Minnesota enacted in 2008 a non-refundable credit for low-income military retirees of up to $750. So that's Minnesota's main way of recognizing military retirement income under current law. And then there are 3 other states that exclude some retirement income subject to income and age limitations. So there are some states that have an exclusion that's very limited to low-income older taxpayers. So it's sort of a mixed bag as to how states deal with the issue.
Thank you, Ms. Manzi. Representative Dabney, then Lesh. Representative Dabney?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. 2 questions. As we're searching for data, maybe Ms. Manzi can help on this. What percentage of Minnesotans who have served in the military, whether it's Guard or Reserve or full-time status in any of the branches, would become eligible for this?
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, I don't think I have an answer to that question. We don't have a database that tracks people when they enter the military as a Minnesotan, and then they may become a resident of another state, particularly if they're in the full-time military. So that I don't think we have any data that will keep track of those people as being former Minnesotans. I think probably the 2 groups to think of, well, actually the 3 groups to think of in looking at this are the survivors, the people who are in the Guard and Reserve, and the people who are in the full-time military. My intuition is that members of the full-time military may be a little more footloose when it comes to their residence decisions when they separate from the military, because they may have been stationed at different places around the country and around the world and had opportunities to change their residency to another state from Minnesota as they went around. Members of the National Guard are at the other extreme, where they tend to be affiliated with a Guard, I don't know what to call the unit, but that is associated with an armory in Minnesota, and they're Minnesota residents. They may be deployed overseas. They may be deployed to assist with immigration duties along the border. I think that's happened with the Minnesota National Guard, but they typically don't go somewhere and live for 2 years at a time in another state. while they're performing their duties, they typically remain Minnesotans. So they're less likely to have gone somewhere else as a result of their military duty.
Dabney?
One other quick question for Ms. Manzi. How are we defining military for the purposes of this legislation? I usually think of the four branches, but I sometimes see that people include the Coast Guard as a fifth branch, and particularly since Coast Guard now are sometimes being deployed overseas, helping manage port security in Kuwait, and I don't know what all else. But are we defining it strictly as the four branches, or do we include the Coast Guard as part of that?
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, I'm not sure about that. I know that it gives some information. The reference in the bill is to the U.S. code through which the military retirement benefits are paid, and there are three chunks in there. There's one chunk that's for people who are in the regular military, so the first set of numbers in the code reference are that. The second set of numbers are the survivor benefits, and the third single number that's a lot different from the other two numbers is the National Guard and Reserve component. And I'm not sure if the Coast Guard retirement is paid through that first grouping or if it's paid another way. I do have a document in one of my folders here from the actuary's report that I know it lists the Coast Guard separately, and if I can find that, I can look at it, and it might illuminate things a little bit.
All right. Thank you. And I just appreciate staff using words like chunk, as the rest of us do when discussing tax issues. Thank you, Ms. Manzi. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to highlight first, in light of Representative Dabney's question, that I have, you know, my unit in Rochester, I've got a certain percentage of my privates who live in Wisconsin or Iowa, which incidentally also Western Wisconsin and Northern Iowa are largely part of the 34th Infantry Division, which are part of the 1st Brigade Combat Team that are going to be deploying this April. So it can have a different effect on them too, even though we're trying to take care of our own here in Minnesota. My question is, when I look at this, both, and it's related a little bit to Representative Detmer's bill as well as this, but I think when I talk to Representative Detmer about the bill, we're talking, depending on obviously the most typical amount of benefit, we're talking anywhere from 5 to 10 grand and more money in your pocket at the end of a tax year as compared to without the benefit, if it isn't restricted. So when you look at that, I look, okay, I'm getting 5 grand, maybe 8 grand back, and I'm deciding where I'm going to live. There are a lot of part of the country, many parts of the country, where that's not going to make up a difference. If I'm looking to move near my family in the greater New York metropolitan area, that's not going to make up for what I would take a loss in with respect to the additional benefit that I would get if New York or New Jersey or Philadelphia had that benefit. So I'm wondering if this is really in order to get more military retirees here, as opposed to, as Representative Erickson said, honor their service. I'm fully there with respect to honoring the service, but how much of a difference is this really going to make? Do we know, Ms. Manzi or anyone else who may have the data around here, the variations in cost of living around the country of where people would choose to live seem to me to be much greater than the differential that this benefit would confer. Am I wrong, or is there just no data to analyze that?
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, before I attempt to address Representative Lesh's question, I think I found some illumination on the Coast Guard, and I believe that the Coast Guard is included in the Department of Defense actuary report. They list retirement benefits for the Coast Guard, and I know that we've relied on their numbers previously to estimate how many retirees there are in the state. So there's that one. Now, Representative Lesh's question, I believe, is whether the tax advantage conferred by this $6,000 exclusion would be large enough to make a difference in a person's location decision in retirement, given the different cost of living they would be facing around the whole country. Is that
correct?
All right. The tax benefit of the retirement of the exclusion, the $6,000 exclusion for someone who is in the 7% bracket, is going to be roughly $400 to $500 per year. So if you exclude $6,000, that's how much your taxes will go down, is $400 or $500 a year. So putting it in that context, I'm not aware of any data that compare the cost of living in the different states versus the benefits for their taxation of military retirement income, but I'll just maybe stop there, that it's going to be $400 or $500 of tax benefit.
Representative Lesh? No further
questions. Okay, with that, Representative Coonan, we will lay House File 15 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. With that, Representative Coonan, I think we're going to go to Representative Nelson because you're on the committee, so you'll be here for your next bill if that's okay.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Nelson, if you could please join us. I will move House File 108 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Representative Nelson, if you're welcome to the committee, sir, if you could please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I'm Representative Nelson, and I have a constituent here, Karen Dobson. She brought this bill forward to me through an email asking about this. I guess there's a move to do this across the nation to try and help in the multiple sclerosis research, and this is basically a simple bill. It just adds a checkoff to the tax form, similar to the chickadee checkoff, for that contributions will be directed to our MS research and assistance. And I will let Ms. Dobson tell her story.
Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
My name is Karen Dobson.
D-O-B-S.
D as in dog, O, B as in boy, S-O-N.
And I'm sorry, your first name again?
Karen.
Karen. Welcome to the committee, Karen.
Thank you. And I represent myself, I guess. Well, let me see. I can tell you how I came here. I have MS. I was diagnosed in 1997. A couple months ago, I was reading a magazine, the National MS Society magazine, and there was an article in there about other states having a checkbox on their state tax forms where citizens could set aside money to give to MS research. And I thought that sounded like a good idea. And also at that time, I was in a class at North Hennepin Community College, American Government and Politics, and my teacher kind of inspired me or made me think that, you know, a person can make a difference and you have to take action and get involved. So I decided to write a letter, and I wrote a letter to Representative Nelson asking him what I would need to do or how you would make that happen. And then I got a call to come here. You know, probably most people in this room know a little bit about MS. It's a neurological disease. Symptoms can vary by person, and you can have different symptoms in different flare-ups. Some of them include blindness, numbness, weakness, tingling, bowel, bladder problems. Really, there's just many things that you can experience. You know, for me, I've been fortunate. I can still function. I walk. I work full time. I go to school. There are a lot of people that, you know, can't work because of this disease. I think having a checkbox on the form. I've been told that it was highly unlikely that this committee would ever agree to something like that, and I understand the reason why, but I guess I was thinking, why not? I mean, we already have a checkbox on there for conservation, and to be frank, you know, most people just ignore it. They don't usually put anything in there. So I figured, well, why not try something different and put it, you know, add a checkbox to let people choose if they want to give some money to helping with MS research. And there are all kinds of other diseases that are probably worse, but they're close to a cure for MS. And maybe if they could solicit additional funds, that would be the nudge to get them to the cure. And if you had to look at benefits, I mean, there are people that, if there was a cure, there'd be less people on disability, there'd be, the employers would have more of a full-time workforce, there's less health costs. You know, to me, it's an investment. I guess that's it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Dobson. Any questions for Ms. Dobson, Representative Bisgins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this might be a question of the chair or research. Because we're obviously going to see a number of good causes or potentially see a number of good causes, and that's appropriate, and I do applaud Ms. Dobson for her testimony. But do we have any information on right now what is the administrative costs of the non-game wildlife checkoff? How much as people check this off and direct money to that fund, how much costs are tied up in the bureaucracy of doing that? Do we have any information that you're aware of?
Mr. Michael or Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chairman, we don't know exactly what the department's administrative costs are. That is something we could ask the department to provide information on. I don't know if there's somebody here from the department who knows that.
Yes, we have a... We have a gentleman here. If you could step down, please, sir, and address Representative Bisgins' question. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I was just conferring with some of the colleagues of the department. We don't have a good figure for you, but that's something we, the department can provide.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I would like that that information, because there's going to be costs if the state is the one who creates the funnel rather than a direct contribution to the MS Society itself. And that's my other question. Mr. Michaels, is a direct contribution to the MS Society? Well, first, on the non-game wildlife checkoff, I believe that either increases your tax liability or it decreases your refund, does it not?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bisgins, that's correct. It does. It's a contribution. It's not allocation of essentially government money. So, and not always well known by folks, but that is also tax deductible. So when you check off $100 for the non-game wildlife, you can take that if you itemize deductions as a charitable deduction on the federal and state return.
We shouldn't say that too loud.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, but that was the other thing I was going to say. It makes things a little convoluted, but the direct donation to the MS Society is a non-taxable event, is it not?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bisgins, it would be essentially the same effect if you make a deduction. I assume that that's a 501c3, and so therefore it's a deductible charitable contribution. It's not something that there's a tax on, in any sense. The one thing that maybe is useful to point out about this, the way this bill is structured, and I don't believe that the non-game wildlife works that way, but the administrative costs would be taken out of the contributions. So essentially, they would get the net amount, not the gross amount.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and that is important for the contributor to know that, and that's not readily transparent on the action of the checkoff itself to the contributor. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Bisgins. Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I had somebody whisper in my ear from the research that they've requested a fiscal note on this, but in the past they said it's roughly about $88,000 for the first year of the program, and then it drops down to $44,000 a year administrative costs going forward from there.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Nelson. Any other? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure I'm clear on that. So Mr. Michaels, you said that they recoup the costs of administering it through whatever donations are made. Is that correct?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that's correct. That's the way the bill is written. So essentially, it would not increase the, you know, it wouldn't come out of the department's regular appropriation.
Representative Anderson.
So, Mr. Chair, and I don't know if Representative Nels can answer this or if Mr. Michaels can answer this. So then, if the cost is $88,000, is it possible if they only got, you know, 10 donations of a dollar apiece that they would be on the line for the administrative costs?
Mr. Michael?
Because that doesn't change whether or not...
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, can never exceed the contribution. So essentially it can be deducted from the contributions, yeah. But it wouldn't create a liability beyond that, if that's what your question is.
Representative Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, I'm just curious, as you know, the state is going to have administration costs of this regardless, because they're going to have to put it on the form, and I know we've talked about putting these things on the forms makes it more lengthy, it's more costly to produce and so forth, and so I'm just wondering if we're going to still be able to recoup those costs and if those are factored in, and I don't know if Representative Nelson, if you've had some conversations with the department about that or not.
I have not, as when I brought this forward. Look, there's different models that are out there. Some of the states that have put this on have not written it this way to recoup the cost, and so it just falls on the administration. And I wrote it this way as a model out of another state, so that the cost would be recouped, so that, again, we're not putting additional burdens on the department. But as the fiscal analyst here just told me, that we do not recoup the cost. That's picked up by the administration, and they would have to, if it doesn't meet the $88,000 the first year or $44,000 thereafter, they would then have to pick up those costs to administer it.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Anderson. Okay. Any other questions? Representative Brownback?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And perhaps Mr. Michael can answer this. But I'm noticing that, okay, we're going to deposit the money in a... Is that a federal or state account, or is that a new account that's being set up on multiple sclerosis research and assistance account? And then I'm noticing that the proceeds can... There's a couple ways they might be used. So who makes those decisions? Do we know that?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, this account would be established in the state's general fund, and so, you know, it would be accounted for separately, but, you know, it would be, the monies would obviously both be commingled in the, you know, in the state's various bank accounts. In terms of, you know, the decision about where the money goes, or who's going to make the decisions, it's basically a grant to this, you know, to the MS Society, and so they would be the ones that, just like any charitable contribution, it's, you know, you give the money to the organization, and they decide typically what best ways to spend it. It has to be used for research and programs and services and financial assistance, so it's a fairly broad set of things that they can use it for.
Representative Brownback?
Well, yes, Mr. Chair. I mean, could we have that confirmed perhaps by the author then? It's going to the specific chapter, the Minnesota chapter? And
Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Runbeck. And yes, they would be going to the MS chapter to service people, both for research and for assistance to patients with MS. And if further questions, I have Ted Thompson here from the MS Society. He can answer some of those questions if you'd like.
Representative Runbeck?
I'd like to hear from him.
Okay, if you please state your name and we represent the record, please, sir.
Sure. Thank you, Chairman Davids, members of the committee, Representative Runbeck. We've got roughly 10,000.
Sir, if you could please state your name.
Oh, I'm
and
sorry.
Who you represent for the record, please.
Ted Thompson, Senior Vice President for Public Policy and Mission Advancement with the MS Society Minnesota Chapter.
Thank you, sir.
Yes. we provide great number of products and programs and services for the 10,000 people in Minnesota with MS. Everything from respite relief for their caregivers to exercise programs, professional conferences. We've got over 80 clubs and groups spread throughout the state of Minnesota for people with MS. We also provide direct financial assistance for people who with MS who are having problems paying, whether it be their bills or if they need assistance to purchase something that helps them in their daily life. Like we just added e-readers to that because a lot of people with MS have visual impairment. We also have emergency financial assistance. We do all these programs, and we raise a great deal of money for research. All of that's accomplished with no state or federal tax funds. We're completely privately funded. We raise all the money ourselves to provide these. And, of course, having this tax checkoff would be an additional revenue source. It's budget neutral because the bill provides that the administrative costs would be paid for out of the fund. And just for an example, with regard to the administrative costs, that $88,000 seemed extremely high, and so I'm not sure where that's from. But Wisconsin, when they adopted a similar provision, what I've got here is that their 2008 administrative fees were only $2,400. Now, I don't know what that amounts to either, but I could get more information on that.
Representative Brownback?
Well, I'm getting enough information, I think, Mr. Chair. You know, in general, I really appreciate that Ms. Dobson has brought this forth as well. I'm curious to know how many of these have come forward in the past over the, you know, it seems like then everyone would kind of want this. The precedent, you know, bothers me. So I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. Representative Gottwalt?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to build a little bit on Representative Runbeck's comments, I guess my concern, Representative Nelson, I mean, MS is a wonderful cause. On my Health and Human Services Reform Committee, we hear about multiple conditions that are very very concerning, whether it's Alzheimer's or MS or you name it. And many organizations that would like to be able to raise money, and I just question the state's role here in using our tax forms as a conduit for fundraising for organizations. You know, there are literally thousands of good cause organizations in the state, and I just question whether this is something we want to do more of. I fully respect the desire of nonprofits to raise money, and this would be another conduit. I understand it pays for itself administratively, but again, where does this go? Do we end up with a whole other two or three pages on the form for all the organizations that want to be doing good things and using the tax form as a means of funneling or creating an opportunity, at least, for people to funnel money to them?
Representative Wardlow?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question for Mr. Thompson, I think. have you considered or analyzed whether having a checkoff like this in other states or this proposed checkoff in Minnesota and the publicity of it and the fact that it's available and people know about it affects other private donors and their decisions to donate to your foundation?
Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't have any data on that. I do. There was some anecdotal evidence provided that when there are multiple options, it tends to increase the number of people who make a donation. But again, that was more anecdotal. We don't have anything scientific on that.
Representative Wardlow?
Just to quickly follow up, I guess my fear here is building on Representative Gottwalt's and Rumbeck's comments that should these checkoffs, state mechanisms for providing funds to private charities become too widespread, it might discourage other avenues for private charities, giving to private charities, and perhaps it might actually, in the long run, have an outcome that is contrary to the intended outcome of increased revenues.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, Representative, I understand that concern. I think there's some logic to that. We would, we've got a very vast network of supporters, volunteers. We do a number of events throughout the state, so our plan would be to very much publicize this and everything we do so that people knew about that option. That being said, other groups may not have that capacity, and I think your concern is legitimate that, you know, other checkoffs might actually not do as well. And you've seen some of that with the license plate experience, where we have so many of them that some of them don't do as well, in part because they're not publicized.
Okay, Representative Nelson, Representative Wardlow?
No.
Representative Nelson, do you have anyone else who wishes to testify for the bill? Is there anyone here that has concerns about the bill in the audience? Okay, with that, we will lay House File 108 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you very much, Representative Nelson and Ms. Dobson and Mr. Thompson. Thank you,
Mr. Chair and committee, for hearing that.
In announcement, we will go with Representative Detmer next. House File 82. House File 82, if you could please step forward, Representative Detmer. And also I'll announce to the committee, we had announced at our last committee meeting that we'd be breaking at 11:30 tomorrow to get over for the State of the State. We're going to be moving that up to 11:15. We've had a request that we be over on the floor by 11:30, so hopefully 15 minutes will allow us to do that. So wherever we're at in the committee, if we're in the middle of a bill or an amendment, at 11:15 the gavel goes down and we'll pick up the bill that we're in the middle of at a later date. Also, I'd like to announce, and you should be getting this, it's in your packet, tax, I'm referring over to the Property and Local Tax Division, House Files 88 Debke, 99 Anzelks, 240 Detmer, 317 Abler, 321 Poppy, 336 and 337 and 338 and 357 Lincheski, 377 Shemansky, 385 Detmer, and 398 Lincheski. So just, I'd like to announce that for the record, and members, you should have that information in your packet. So with that, welcome to the Tax Committee. Representative Detmer, I'll move House File 82, and the motion will be to lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. There are a couple handouts that we have for members. Are these out or going out? That are going out right now, so if they refer to these, you should have these very shortly. Representative Detmer, welcome to the Tax Committee. And if you could please present your bill, and I'll ask right up front, is there any, you've got several folks who wish to testify on behalf of your bill. Is there anyone in the audience who would wish to testify against this bill, House File 82? Okay, seeing none, what that generally means in this committee, Representative Detmer, is that you're looking good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members. And House File 82 has similarities to Representative Coonan's bill that was presented earlier. But House File 82 is a phase-in of what we're trying to do here. The bill would allow subtraction of the Minnesota taxable income and alternative minimal taxable income at a percentage of the pension or other federal retirement pay received in service of the military. The percentage is 10% phase in on the year 2012 and 20% on tax year 2013 and 30% thereafter. However, the percentage of increases by 10% percentage points per year until the percentage reaches 70%. And if the number of taxpayers claiming this subtraction in any given year with the tax year 2015 is at least 1,500 greater than the number claiming in 2012.
Excuse me, Representative Detmer, would you like me to get the bill in the shape you'd like? Do you want the DE-1 amendment?
We have a DE-1 amendment. It's a delete all amendment. Yes.
That's what you're working
on? Yes,
off
Mr.
Of?
Chairman, yes.
Okay, I will move that the H-0082 DE-1 amendment be passed. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have the amended bill in the shape the author would like. Please continue, sir.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I've got two testifiers here that I'd like to bring on. Mr. Donais, would you please introduce yourself?
Okay. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Yes, sir. My name is Ralph Donais. I'm the chairman of the United Veterans Legislative Council of Minnesota. I'm also a 30-year retired Marine, having served from 1964 to 1994 in the Marine Corps.
Sir, could you please spell your name for the record, your last name?
It's on this form, sir, D-O-N-A-I-S, the one that lists all the data on the states.
Oh, okay. Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir.
Please proceed.
I brought this information forward to you today to give you an idea where Minnesota sits in regard to other states in the United States. If you look at that chart, we're way down there at 33. We're towards the bottom of the chart. The data came from the DOD actuary, and I was informed this morning that that address that I have at the top, as things change on the internet, that address has changed slightly. But if you go into the internet and go to dod.military.actuary, something will come up that will get you to the right place. To answer a question earlier, there are 67 Coast Guard retirees in Minnesota. You can get all that information off the actuary if you go in there. If you look down the right side of this form, it says that we have only increased 0.05% in the last 9 years. Minnesota has not attracted a lot of military retirees over the last 9 years. Minnesota, with its industry, should be 1.5 to 2% higher than it is. And when I got ready to retire, one of the first things they said in the transition assistance program at the base was, here are the states that fully tax you. You really don't want to move there. And I'll tell you right up front, the reason I'm in Minnesota is because this is where Mama wanted to live. As it was mentioned earlier, we live all over the United States, so we've seen several states across the country. My wife and I lived in 30 different houses in 28 years. So we moved around the United States a lot. And there are a lot of places that I could have come to, but this is where Mama wanted to be. Along with that, if you stop and think about the increase in revenues coming into the state, a 2% increase in military people coming into the state would be $500 million more dollars spent in our state. Currently, second career military bring over $250 million into our state's economy. When we come into the state, we don't burden the state at all with medical or any of that because we're covered by our medical coverage from DOD. Under the new GI Bill, another thing that you need to take into account is that now our dependents can use the GI Bill. The people from NSCU were definitely in favor of this bill because it brings more dependents into the state. Someone who retires at around 20 years probably has a high school student or maybe a college student just starting college, and those funds are going to go directly to all of our colleges, which will help reduce the burden on the state budget for paying for all of our colleges around the state. On the back side of the sheet, on the opposite side, if you just like it was just some data of how Minnesota has changed over the last 9 years. And if you look there, you see that we've only increased 0.05% in the last 9 years. And this comes off of that DOD actuary. That's where I got the numbers from. Compared to the state of Wisconsin, because they always compare us to South Dakota or Wisconsin or Iowa or somebody around us, if you look at that, every year Wisconsin has gained more and more money into their state from second career military paychecks. In the last 9 years, Wisconsin has gained over $207 million more into their economy than Minnesota has because they went tax exempt way back there in 2001. So at this time, if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them for you.
Any questions for Mr. Donay? Or Sam Valesh?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Donay, were you really at the end of your career, were you really, did you have no opinions about where to go or no ideas about it as opposed to, I think you said, was it your wife who really wanted to live here? How much of a factor in the tax or the pension tax rate, where did that fall in your priorities for where you wanted to live at the time you retired?
Mr. Donay?
Mr. Chair, Representative, when I retired, I was the avionics chief for the Marine Corps. It means I was a senior enlisted person in the United States. I had job offers to live all over the United States. But I chose Minnesota because this is where my wife wanted to live. Personally, I love the mountains of Tennessee and that area when I lived down in that area. It had, for me personally, it doesn't, but I've sat through enough of those retirement seminars that that the main question that's asked is, how much is my pension going to be taxed if I move to that state? And I've had contact with bases all over the world, being associated with the Retired Enlisted Association, and that's one of the main questions that's asked at the retirement seminars.
Representative Lesh?
I hope I answered your question.
You did, and I'm trying to get a beat on it, because as I know people who begin their retirement, there are just very different reasons, and one of them is, can I afford to live in a certain location, whether it's because of the type of job they're getting offered or because of the tax rate. I also want to thank you for sending me a lot of your Marines, too. About one-third of my unit is former Marines, so appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
Any other questions for Mr. Donay? Okay, your next testifier, Representative Detmer.
Mr. Dan Severson.
Welcome, committee, sir. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Dan Severson, and I am a 22-year Navy veteran. We have worked on this bill for a protracted amount of time, and so I'm just going to kind of cursory go over where this bill is coming from and where it's probably differentiated from the first hearing that was in the Veterans Committee a little bit. As many members may not know, in 1978, this state had military pay exemption. In 1978, the legislature saw fit to take that money and put it towards the budget, evidently. There are probably some in the legislature now who were here at that time who would understand the circumstances around that. But the bottom line is, this is not foreign to Minnesota. We are one of six states that currently tax military pension. And so part of this process is to undo that and make Minnesota competitive. This bill is about making Minnesota competitive for people who have talents who are leaving. And as Representative Lesh had spoke, what are the decision processes when you go into getting out of the military? There's a transition assistance program that goes to every retiree, and one of the first things they do is put before you a plate of 50 states, and they talk about the benefits and shortcomings of each of those particular states. Minnesota says, we got cold weather, few bases, and by the way, we tax your income. One of six states that tax your military pension. So right off the get-go, if you've got talented people who are looking for a place to settle and bring their intellectual property there, you're putting a huge negative stop sign up to them. Now, part of this process, and I understand we're in a $6.2 billion budget shortfall, and this is a bad time to bring a bill forward that begins to give some tax considerations to a particular group. That's why we've tailored this bill the way we have. Currently, 10%, the way the bill is written up, 10% would be excluded from from taxation in year 11 to 12. And via the fiscal note that came out, I think that was about $2.1 million. And then in the next year, it would increase to 20%, which would be about another $2.2 million. And then in the third year, ending up in 2014 at about $6.8 million. I'm not sure why it increases over $2.1 million rather than going linear, goes up quicker, or if that's a phase-in of inflationary index. I have some real questions in the numbers that have been put forth here, 16,700, and how many of those, as the question has been before, how many of those are Minnesota reservists? Whether or not, and I guess this would be to Ms. Manzi, in terms of whether or not this number takes into effect the Guard, who would be under Title 32 under their service and then go to Title 10, is this money coming directly out of DFAS?
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Detmer's bill, House File 82, is drafted to allow the income tax subtraction for retirees from the full-time military, from the Guard and Reserve, and for people who receive survivor benefit payments. So the 16,700 figure in the estimate would include all three of those groups.
Mr. Okay. Severson?
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Manzi. Yeah, that's part of this process, is to say the people that are second career military are the ones that are coming from the four groups typically, and then possibly the Coast Guard as well, I think, is included in that group. But the people we're really trying to recruit are those that would not normally come back to Minnesota, whether they've been here before or whether they're looking at Minnesota as a final resting place. So let me get back to the whole
final
issue.
Final resting place sounded so permanent.
Yeah, resting place as in second career, yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, with that, Mr. Severson, you still have the floor here, but we just had the pages pass out some information that kind of dovetails off of Mr. Donay's information, where, because we had this question, the Veterans Committee was, okay, number of military retirees, percentage of all the military retirees from the country, and then we went out one more category, the percentage of the state's population.
Yes.
And so you can see where Minnesota falls on that sheet. Mr. Severson, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, and in terms of the number of retirees in the United States at large, we've got about 300 million in the United States. Of that, about 1.94 are retirees, 1.94 million. Minnesota has a population of about 5 million, which means that our retiree population in the state of Minnesota, if we were proportional to the number of retirees that have retired from the military, should be about 32,000. We currently have, per those numbers, 16,700. Of those, 16,700 bring a revenue of around $260 million into the state in terms of DFAS dollars that come in. Now, that does not include the second career pays that those individuals are going, because once they retire, they're retiring at 45 to 50 to the early 50s, and they're going on to second careers, and those careers typically are, if not six digits, they're close to six-digit salaries. Those are already going to be taxed, but per the issue here being is they're not going to come to Minnesota and bring that second career pay here unless we create some incentives to get them here. And that's what this bill is about. Now, 10% isn't a lot to start with. And we go up to 30%, and what the bill does is it basically says we're going to cap it at 30% until we see a 1,500 increase in the population from the date of enactment. So when we see that 1,500 increase, we're talking about another probably $30 million in terms of DFAS revenue that's going to come into this state. And then once that has hit that mark, then it goes up to 70, and then another 15 for about 3,000, which brings in an additional $90 million into the state for revenue. And that's used on about a 30,000 average pay for retirees at about a 1,300 per year tax advantage for those individuals. So having said that, it's capped so that there's minimal output, and when we have proven that the system is going to recruit new talent to the state of Minnesota, as you see the numbers increase, it begins to be offset by those increased numbers. I hope I explained that, you know, somewhat coherently, but the bottom line is we understand that there's a fiscal impact to this. We're trying to marginalize the fiscal impact and prove that this system is going to recruit new talent to the state. Now, one of the prefaces that was on the summary, I think, that I read on this is that Minnesota's military retiree count is going up by 1,500 every 4 years. Well, that's simply not the case. When I started this bill in 2005, we had about, I think it was about 15,600 individuals. And that was about 7 years ago. And now they're saying 16,700. I'm not sure where those numbers are coming from, but if that was in fact the case, 10 years ago we would have had 10,000 retirees in the state, and that's not the case. We've seen our numbers stagnate. We've seen them go down in some circumstances, so I think if we're going to do an actual trend of this, we'd have to go back 20 years, take a look at it from the enactment of 1978 when the military pension began to be taxed, and then see the trends looking from that vantage point. But I want to close with this. These are why I think this is such an important bill and why these individuals should have the consideration of this committee and of the legislature in order to recruit them to this state. These are all senior executives. These members have been through the military for 20 or 30 years. They've been leaders in their communities. They're sought out by Fortune 500 companies. They're looking for a community to settle in and buy a house. After they've had a career, they still have to go somewhere, buy a house, and invest themselves in the community. So you're looking at them putting money into the housing market. You're looking at them looking for second career jobs that are going to be, and they have a high rate of volunteerism. They're continuously upward mobile in their military career, and so they're going to be such in the private sector as well. They're screened regularly for drugs, and they're tested annually for stringent physical fitness requirements. Spouses often are professionals who they're bringing with them into the community, and these individuals are also going to bring high salary pays. If not high salary, they're going to be very active in the volunteerism side. They bring their own health care coverage. They're highly educated and entrepreneurs looking for a new start. And in a military term, these are non-indigenous assets that are highly mobile and do the research. To the TAPS, case in particular, they do the research before they move to a particular state. They're gonna analyze. Because they've been in successful career in their careers, they don't get there just because they let things happen. They do it because they plan. And so part of this process is to say, you know what, Minnesota is interested in recruiting you as a talent to the state. We're interested in making you a viable part of our community. And we are going to have a process here in which we may still tax part of your income, but we're going to gradually phase that out. So I would stand for any questions, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Severson. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Representative Detmer, thank you for bringing this forward. Would it be fair to, for either you or Commander Severson, by the way, good to see you again.
Good to see you.
Would it be fair to characterize this? The message we're basically delivering here is, would it be fair to characterize it as, this is a small investment on the part of the state. It obviously has a fiscal note, but the return is manifold. We're going to end up with a lot more out of that, as well as good treatment of our veterans.
Representative Detmer.
That'd be a fair characterization.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Gottwald, I think, you know, even with the time that we're in right now with the economy, and we still got to look forward how we can benefit the state budget by bringing this talent into the state of Minnesota. And that's a hard decision that we're all going to have to make, if this is an investment and that we can count on a return. And right now, the one half of the retired population in Minnesota is over 65. In terms of the military retired, they're over 65 right now. And we want to draw on that, the young talent, bring them into the state. As Mr. Donais pointed out, they're going to buy homes here. They've been traveling all over the world. On a personal note, I have a son in Afghanistan right now. He's been in Iraq twice, and my other son has been. Same situation. They've been traveling from different state to state. We hope that someday they'll bring the grandkids here in Minnesota, retire here. But that's a personal note. But Mr. Severson has spent a lot of time with this bill, and I appreciate him coming in and sharing the background and what we're trying to do here. And we need to be a state to attract this workforce. It is a workforce, and they're very talented. Many of them have degrees they've worked on while they're in the service, and now they can bring their families here and retire here, and many of them will go on to college and so forth with their GI Bill. So I just appreciate being able to bring this into the committee, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gottwald. Representative Loeffler, Leshton, Rukavina. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I was just intrigued by this handout that was just presented. It's from Nina Manzi from our House Research Department, and it's using Department of Defense data from 2009, and it shows that Minnesota has 31 hundredths of a percent of its population in military retirees. And the state of Wisconsin, which has often been mentioned as the comparison because it's had 9 years of tax exemption, is at only 0.32 of a percent in terms of military retirees. So I would say, you know, I'm not sure if that shows that this has really been as effective as some have implied. And I think, you know, we really need to look at the real data. I personally have been someone who's really strongly supported our education programs to help people coming out of the military get into good positions, and many of those are people who haven't served 20 years, but they've been on the front lines of combat. The people who have served 20 years often come into the job market with some real skills, and so I think, to me, the question is, if we're going to spend $2 to ultimately $10 million a year on workforce development, you know, what's the best investment? And I don't serve on the economic development committees, but I do think we need to weigh that, because I think our investments in those educational supports of our veterans are, to me, really important, and they help launch a lot of people into a long-term successful career, not just a second career. And so, but I was surprised that that this data seems to raise some questions about the effectiveness of the Wisconsin program and making a difference, since the percentages as a percent of their total population is less.
Even though the numbers are different, that's because our states have different populations.
Thank you.
So I just ask that we think about this as we lay it over and consider other bills as well and priorities.
Thank you, Representative Lopper.
And Mr. Chair, one thing we'd have to do, Representative, is to take a look at where Wisconsin was back in 2001, what their numbers were like and how that they've improved during that time. So that's something maybe that report doesn't indicate where they were at in 2001.
So. Okay, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dittmer, I'm looking at that same list, and I noticed at the top of the list, all those states are major military posts or have some major military posts, and for the most part, the bottom of the list, there are no major military posts, except I see Kentucky, Fort Campbell, Missouri, Leonard Wood, Louisiana, Fort Polk, not that big, and then at the bottom, you got Fort Drum, New York, and Fort Dix, New Jersey, but for the most part, the bottom of the list is mostly clear of major military posts. How is there a point of diminishing returns where, because of decisions made over the course of the last 100 years and base closures, people retire, they grow up in those states because they're children of military personnel, they tend to be more likely to enlist than the average population as a whole. Is there a point of diminishing returns where even if we do put forth a full effort, if we're just talking about this from a ROI perspective, that we're not getting the bang for the buck? I agree with you that more people are going to want to live in Minnesota and Wisconsin than they are in Wisconsin, but that's me because I'm from Minnesota. Despite the fact that we're close now with the differential on benefits. So where do you think the diminishing returns would be because we just don't have those major post assets that other states have?
Representative Dittmer?
Well, I think one thing that we have in our area is the National Guard and the Reserve component, which is performing more and more active duty services than they've ever had before. The President is calling up our Guard and our Reserve components. We have, of course, Camp Ripley and Fort Snelling. Those are the only areas that we have in Minnesota. And the same with Wisconsin. Basically, you got Fort McCoy. So most of the active duty, almost all the active duty ones except for New York and some of the areas have the active duty bases down in the southern part of the United States. And to answer your diminishing return, I don't know how we would evaluate that.
Okay. Mr. Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's a good question, Representative Lesh. And I think one of the issues that we need to do here is we need to create a recruiting potential here, and this bill is part of that recruiting potential. And what we're saying with this particular bill is if it's not working, we cap it at 30%. It doesn't go any more than 30%, but we're going to see some increase, and as that increase comes up, it'll begin to pay for itself. This bill doesn't move any further than 30%, and then it can be reviewed by the legislature at some further date if the numbers don't justify its implementation, and as it's implemented, then it pays for itself. We have to, as Minnesota, as you said, we don't have a lot of base assets to draw people here. It's cold. And so we have a vision of Minnesota being a entrepreneurial center of economic development boon. And in order to facilitate that, you have to have the intellectual property to facilitate that. These are the individuals that you want to draw. These are the Fortune 500 people that the Fortune 500 companies are looking for. And if we put our hands up to them and say, you know what, there are a lot of other states that are interested in this talent, and they are, and they actively recruit this base, then we lose out. And we need every advantage, and this bill is part of that.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Dittmer?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. And we do have companies here in Minnesota that do have military contracts. And when the workforce is such where you have a military background, you have skill sets, or you have security clearances and so forth, there are opportunities for keep that workforce here.
Representative Lesh. Representative Rukavina, then Wardlow. Then we do have another bill. We have House File 18 that we'd like to take a look at, but I don't want to cut this debate off here. Representative Rukavina and Wardlow.
Representative Rukavina. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dittmer, or Doc, whichever one wants to answer. The bill, it seems to be a more of an economic development bill, but I'm so if that's the argument behind it, why not a exemption for pensions for, you know, professors who did research at a major university, or people who got a pension from IBM or did technology research? Why is it just for military pensions and not other pensions of folks that have very good research skills and could contribute to the economy too?
Representative Detmer?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and Representative Rukavina. I think it was pointed out before that you know, the people that have these positions already in Minnesota, they've been living in Minnesota. They have homes. They have careers here. And whereas if we're going to be attracting the second career military, they've been moving around the country. They don't possibly, more than likely, they don't own homes. But if we want to attract them here, this is one way that we can be more attractive.
Well, Mr. Chair, Rukavina. I mean, researchers at public educational institutions move around the country. We got, you know, one running for Board of Regents who was the president out at Maine's Land Grant College. People that work for different technological and do technological research for IBM or 3M or whatever, they move around the country. So, you know, why not for them?
Mr. Severson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Rokovina, and we sat in the Higher Education Committee together, and there are some huge packages that these researchers get offered by the... And we're not talking about a huge benefit here. We're talking about $1,500 for, on the average, for a military retiree. There's a misnomer here that every person that retires from the military gets a $60,000 pension. That's simply not the case. It's probably averaging around $30,000. So they're looking for a second career. They're looking for a community to plant their talents in. And when you're talking about professors at universities, you're talking about highly coveted that are in competition across the country from different learning institutions that are offering them hundreds of thousands of dollars in salary and other benefits besides that. This is very focused on a very specific talent group of individuals who have been in the military, proven leaders, proven managers, and we're saying to them, we want to create an atmosphere that says come to Minnesota. This is a very focused bill. If you, Representative Rokovina, if you want to do one for college professors, I think that would be a separate bill.
Well, Representative Rokovina, there's a misnomer or a miscalculation or a misunderstanding, whatever you want to call it, Doc, about public pensions, too. People walking around here that are saying that public pensions are 30 or 40 or 50 grand a year when they're probably half of that. You know, I've been here when we reduced... actually took a lot of the reductions for pensions from folks because we wanted them to be means tested. And I think, you know, it's great to give a break to whether a person has a military pension or any kind of a pension, but there should be some kinds of a means test as to their income on that too when they get that break. But, you know, I was just wondering why it isn't expanded to other different classifications of employment. And, you know, if it is more because they served in the military, then how about my peers and friends who got drafted in Vietnam or went to Korea and came back and worked in a mine and got a pension from a mining company? That's taxed. Depends on their income, and it's taxed. Why not give them a tax break on that then? They served in the military too, but their pension came from, private sector, even though they were involved and got shot at and everything else and fought for their country. Representative Detmer, it's your bill, so you want to answer that one?
Mr. Chair,
you know. Come on.
In order to qualify for this, you would have to have 20 years of service.
Well, I know. Yeah. The rationale.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, why not for my friends who fought in Vietnam or Korea, for that matter, but Vietnam ones are still working? And they are going to have a pension from maybe the county or from U.S. Steel or Cleveland Cliffs or whatever, and that pension is going to be taxed.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Mr. Rukavina. Again, this bill only applies to the military up 20 years of service.
I know what the
if you know, there's been people that have served in the military maybe 4 to 8 years of their enlistment period. They don't qualify for military retirement.
Representative Rukavina?
Well, Mr. Chair, and that's my point. I mean, You know, it's a special classification just for a particular group of folks who got a pension from the military. And there's other people that served in the military many years and have pensions that aren't going to get this break. And maybe they're just as creative. We don't know that. Maybe they're going to start a company when they retire from U.S. Steel and, you know, make bombs or something that they learned how to make when they were in the military. I don't know that. I don't have a problem with the bill. It costs a lot of money, but my argument, it should be more than means tested and not just primarily from where your pension is coming from.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Rukavina. Representative Wardlaw?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Detmer, for bringing this very important bill forward. Would it be fair to say that this bill not only seeks to attract these wonderful, talented leaders and managers and people that have bright second careers for them to Minnesota and, you know, create energy in our economy, but also given things that have happened, for example, near my district, where Lockheed Martin, kind of the probably the premier defense industry enterprise in Minnesota, recently announced prior to this legislature coming in, announced that it was closing down its facility. With that, 1,000 jobs are, you know, potentially going to be lost here in Minnesota, and affecting hundreds of my constituents and those and constituents all around the area. Would it also be fair to say then that this bill will help prevent perhaps some of those people from leaving our state, keep them here as they look for new jobs, by sending a strong signal that Minnesota cares about what they did for their country, and Minnesota honors their service, and Minnesota wants them to stay?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I don't know if this bill is going to keep a company here. We have to do some other things at the state level to do that, but I think the workforce, if some of those people are working for Lockheed, have a military background or military pensions, you know, they might want to stay in Minnesota and look for other jobs. And we have to remember that the money that's coming in with the retired veterans, it's all federal money coming into Minnesota, and we need to keep that thought too.
Representative Wardlaw?
Thank you.
Representative Lencheski, and then Anderson. Okay, Representative Lencheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Detmer, did you give any thought to finding a way to assist all the combat military folks who would not qualify, which, of course, is the overwhelming majority of people in the military, would be those who would not qualify, the people who are serving us in Iraq and Afghanistan and around the world? I mean, as you've stated, you have to have 20 years in to ever get this benefit, which we know is a very teeny tiny percent of the people who are in the military. And, you know, one of the concerns I've had about this bill in the past is you can earn a Purple Heart and not qualify for this. You can come back brain damaged and not qualify for this. I mean, if we're going to view in the tax code this group of people as special, why is just a small percentage of the people who serve us special? And what's the tax benefit for the overwhelming majority of people who do not ever put 20 years into the military?
Representative Detmer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lencheski, Mrs. Mancy, do you have some background on that information?
Ms. Mancy?
Well, before Ms. Mancy, if I could ask, I do know there are some early retirement options from President Clinton. Mm-hmm. But the data that I have seen is the bulk of folks who are ever serving us in this way will not have 20 years in, ever. And it defies logic that we would leave those people out if we're going to give everyone a tax cut.
Ms. Mancy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lencheski, and members of the committee, Minnesota has a number of income tax provisions related to people who are actively serving in the military. Most military active service pay is exempt from state income tax subtraction, both for the Guard and Reserves and for members of the full-time military, and that includes the drill pay and training pay that members of the Guard and Reserve receive, whether they do that drill here in Minnesota or in another state. Minnesota also provides a combat zone credit of $120 for each month or portion of a month that an individual serves in a combat zone. which they can claim annually when they serve in the combat zone. So they get that right away. They don't have to wait until they've served their 20 years to get their retirement benefit.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Lonchesky.
Thank you. As a follow-up to that, and Mr. Ben, Representative Detmer, you may not know this because I know you're on property taxes, but I can't remember if you're on poll taxes. You know, most of those provisions, I was the chief author of those, mm-hmm. and Representative Broad. And so, you know, we've got a lot of things going for the rank and file, but, you know, we generally in the tax income tax system, income is income. Whether you earn it as a dividend or because you were in the military or because you run a company or because you clean hotel rooms, income is income. So I think Representative Rukavina asked the right question. If we're going to say that people have 20 years in on pensions in areas that we could use them as workers in Minnesota, why would we just pick this group? Why wouldn't we pick people who've worked for 20 years at, you know, Fortune 500 companies, that they just all get their pension income exempted? Or people who have 20 years in you know, whatever sort of, you know, who have degrees in science. I mean, if you could just help me think through philosophically why these folks get an income tax cut compared to everyone else.
Mr. Chair and Representative Leshensky, I guess the bill itself doesn't say 20 years. It says military retirement.
Right.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, you yourself twice already stated they have to have 20 years.
For some reason, that's in my mind.
But that's correct. And that's correct. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is correct, with a few exemptions that President Clinton passed in the 90s where there were some early retirement options. But for the bulk of folks, you have to have 20 years in. And I think people have to think long and hard about why this small subset of Americans would receive this income tax cut. But Representative Detmer, if I can, just a last question is, your bill costs $13.2 million over 3 years, so, you know, it's going to continue to cost money. What revenue do you propose to pay for the bill?
Representative Detmer?
Mr. Chair, again, it's going to be phased in over that time period, and with the number of retirees that are going to be staying in the state of Minnesota, we will benefit from that money that's coming in the state. So, again, as I mentioned before, it's a long term that we're looking at, and if it doesn't go past, it won't go past 30% if we don't get those people to retire here in Minnesota.
Professor Lonchesky.
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, I guess I'm still interested in how you pay for the bill. You know, whether you invest money through giving people tax cuts or you invest money in higher ed, I mean, take your pick, whether it's a spending program or tax committee spending, because that's what this is, a spending bill, costs $13.2 million. You either have to raise revenue to pay for it, or you have to cut something else. So, you know, it just, one of the things I've been kind of confused about in this committee, honestly, Mr. Chair, this year is I'm not really sure when people have ideas, and they're happening on our side of the aisle too, you know, are people going to pay for these ideas? Are they going to propose the tax increase that goes with them? Are they going to propose, you know, cutting something? So, you know, I had heard the statement, this bill, by one of the testifiers, this bill will pay for itself. Well, you know, so does K-12 funding someday. As people go through school and they become 18, they go to college, whatever, it pays for itself as those people come and earn income and run companies and whatever all they do. But we're here now. We have a $6.2 billion deficit, and this bill costs $13.2 million over the next 3 years. And I'm interested to know what people who have new spending bills are thinking about for either cutting other areas or revenue to pay for them. So I don't.
Representative Detmer.
Mr. Chair, again, I really feel this is an investment, and I mean, we talk about what it's going to cost, but what is the long-term investment that we're going to have, and the payback that's going to happen? Because other states have done this. And again, we're one of six states that don't. But I just think it's an investment. I think in the long run, it's going to pay back.
Representative Lonchesky.
Well, Mr. Chair, only, and I know you have another bill you want to hear. It's true we can assert our ideas will pay for themselves, but we do have to. You, Mr. Chair, are going to get a target, and you have to pay for any of these ideas. And you know, I must say I had read in the paper that you were willing to raise revenue. I was kind of stunned to hear that this weekend, because all year I've heard that we don't have a revenue problem, we have a spending problem. So, you know, after this weekend, I learned that it looks like the tax committee is raising revenue. So I'm, and it would explain to me why we're hearing spending bills. And I just, I'm just, you know, I understand that we want to feel our ideas don't really cost anything, but they do. So it just, I, you know, I'll just leave it at that unless, you know, Representative Davids, you want to comment to me. But, you know, I listened carefully all election to what was being said from the gubernatorial candidate on down, Representative Emmer, and everybody who was running on both sides of the aisle, and sort of the, there was a kind of a mocking of a balanced approach and revenue, and you know, I hear people snicker even in this committee when people just of good conscience with different ideas think that a balanced approach or including revenue is a legitimate way to approach the state's deficit. And I know a number of people don't like that, and we can all have a legitimate, honest disagreement. But, you know, there may be some exceptions, but I heard people say, we don't have a revenue problem, we have a spending problem. Government has to live within its means. We're on autopilot to receive 5% more in revenue. We had $30 billion, now people are going to get $32 billion. Representative Biskins himself has pointed out in this committee a couple times this year that even no new revenue means there's already a growth in revenue, because we're going to go from 30 to 32. And then, you know, I've been watching in the Senate and hearing others talking about revenue. So I'm, you know, maybe, Mr. Chair, you can tell me, is something changed since everybody said we didn't need revenue, that now we do need revenue? I'm just wondering.
Well, thank you, Representative Lencheski, for bringing that up. And my first comment would be, don't believe everything you read. Would be my first comment. And when you know how the place works, when you get half the sentence reported and not the other half, the comment was, we will raise revenues of about $32 billion, not raise taxes. So that's that was the comment, and it certainly got a lot of attention. It was very interesting, but that's what the comment was, and it was, you know how the place works.
Mr. Chair, then, just... And I appreciate that, and we're off your bill, but I really do appreciate that. And the room knows that I play a role as a lead, and Representative Davids plays a role as a chair, and I'm glad to hear that, not because we don't feel that there should be a balanced approach, but because people ran on promises that they wouldn't do certain things, and it's February, and it was kind of shocking. And I know Senator Ortman also has talked about raising revenue, and she may have been taken out of context as well, and I just read Representative Roebling's Senator Roebling's comments. And so if I'm understanding you correctly, from the House percent angle, there will be no revenue increases proposed, because that is what people promised. And so I think, you know, we just want to be clear in understanding that as we go forward. I know there are people talking about things like selling assets. You know, these are revenue raisers. Racino, this is a revenue raiser. Repealing tax expenditures, revenue raisers. Increasing fees, revenue raisers. You know, we're assuming those are all off the table. And, you know, we tried really hard to follow what people said and what promises they made. And I'm glad to hear you confirm that there will be no revenue. We might have a different view of that.
Excuse me, Representative Lencheski. Those were my comments. I'm not speaking on behalf of the caucus on that, but I think it's pretty clear what the caucus position is, too. I'm speaking for myself.
And I appreciate that. And you know, we understand how things work here. And you know, I've been trying to do my due diligence to make sure that I know what the 17 Republican members of this committee stated when they ran as it relates to revenue. And I haven't found anyone yet who is willing to spend any revenue in their commitments. So you certainly can't speak for anyone but yourself, and neither can I. But I just, you know, you have to imagine it was pretty shocking for all of us to see that. And I'm glad you've corrected the record that there won't be any revenue going forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, and Representative Lencheski, my comments were that we would raise revenues of about approximately $32 billion. Now, I'm just a poor farm boy from Section 28, Sumner Township, Fillmore County, and we have a committee of however many members we have on each side, and this is where the debate will be, and it'll be a very interesting debate.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, Representative Downey, then Gottwalt, we will be shutting her down at noon, but we will continue the discussion on the Detmer bill. That's what we're on. We do have the Coonan bill, House File
18 that we would like to get to. And Representative Coonan, I would just suggest that you might want to think about how you're going to pay for that bill. It would be good.
Right.
Representative Downey, then Gottwald. Representative Downey.
That's the point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment that I made when we were looking at the tax expenditures report about terminology, and Representative Lencheski just once again referred to the absence of taxation as spending, and we'll continue to hear that, and I just want to make sure that we're clear with our terminology. You may agree it is a reduction in revenue that therefore allows us to spend less in state government, but I think calling it spending is inaccurate terminology, and I don't think we called it a spending cut when we put it in place. I'm guessing it was called a tax increase or a revenue raiser, and so today when we're reversing some portion of that or considering reversing some portion of that, I think accurate terminology would be better reflected if we called it the absence of a tax or an exemption from a tax or relief from a tax. I just want to get us away from this concept that reducing taxation is somehow state spending.
Mr. Chair. We'll go to Representative Gottwald and Lencheski. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just real quickly, because I think we want to stay on the bill, but to the bill and to what we're doing here, I think it's perfectly legitimate to talk about another word we heard on the campaign trail a lot was prioritization, and so it's useful. I agree. I think at some point you got to say, where's the money coming from? Are you going to cut something to do this and shift priorities? I think that's a very legitimate point we have to focus on here on the tax committee, but I think it's legitimate to hear bills that might spend some money if we also want to discuss what we wouldn't do. You know, the fact that we do have $2 billion more revenue coming in doesn't necessarily negate the fact that we got to kind of do those kinds of things. So I don't mind hearing those kinds of bills in the tax committee, frankly, and then maybe we have the discussion about, you know, where does the money come from? Is this a higher priority than another? I think Representative Rukavina's comments about why this group and not another group are legitimate questions to ask. But I don't think it's bad for us to hear bills that might spend some money here in the tax committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Gowell. And we will be hearing a lot of bills, and at some day when we put the bill together, I agree with Representative Lencheski, we do have to pay for it. Members that have bills will certainly hear bills, and we will have to, as a committee, figure out how we pay for them. Representative Lencheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Gottwald, I just agree with everything you said, but I do want to respond to what Representative Downey said, because I think we just disagree. That's just as simple as that. But I want to, you know, to you, Mr. Chair, and to the entire committee, I am not a member who has said repealing tax expenditures or having them is only shrinking government and cutting the deficit, or has said only they are tax increases. I reject the conservative Republican frame on this, and I reject the liberal frame on this. It's both simultaneously. It is absolutely choosing when you choose to not have somebody pay income taxes. The left will generally say that's this, and the right will say this. You know, both sides are right on this. They are all zero-based budgeting. This is exactly what we should be doing. So, you know, I'm not one who will argue the more conservative or liberal angle on this. I think they're choices people make, but I very carefully call them revenue raisers, Mr. Chair, because whether you believe it's letting people keep more of their own money, it's a tax cut, or it's a new spending program, it raises revenue. That is indisputable. And so folks ran on, we don't need any more revenue. So I think looking at these things, and as someone who's carried a lot of bills to try to do zero-based budgeting and pick and choose between tax expenditures, because I think a lot of them you can't even justify them, a lot of them are unfair, and a lot of them disproportionately go to those who need it the least. You can call it a government spending cut or a tax increase. Pick your, you know, your rhetoric, but they all raise revenue. And I did not hear the new majority say we're going to raise any revenue. So I want to get that on the record when we're talking about this stuff. I think for this committee, it is the revenue committee. And Mr. Chair, you've committed to us in the past that you will make sure that everything that raises revenue gets to this committee, and I'm glad to hear that, because there's a lot out there, and I think there's a lot of people are going to try to avoid you, Mr. Chair. So, thank you.
And I just don't understand why. I went back last night and looked at my campaign literature, and I was very happy. I'm very happy to report I didn't promise anything. So, Representative Coonan, a quick question. Do you have any real people that have come in to testify for your bill?
I have one person lined up to testify for.
So, members, we have the Detmer bill before us. If there's no more questions, we will lay over House File 82 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Coonan, if you could please join us here at the table. And if you could, first of all, I think rather than if we have a brief description of your bill by you and then the person to testify, is there anyone that wishes to testify against House File 18? Against or with concerns about House File 18? Okay, Representative Coonan, welcome to your committee. If you could please, Representative Coonan moves that House File 18 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. That'll be the motion. If you could please describe your bill. And then you have one gentleman here to testify on behalf of your bill. Okay, Representative Coonan.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. House File 18 is a sales tax exemption bill that would add grain bins, fencing materials, and ear tags into the list of items that receive sales tax exemption. Now, I need to clarify that ear tags already have a sales tax exemption. This bill was sent to me from the Senate. If had our staff drawn this up, that wouldn't have been in there. But so when you look at the revenue estimate, you can subtract that about $95,000 from the cost, which would bring the cost then to about $5,190,000 for 2012 and about $5,200,000 for 2013. The bill also, there's a part of a statute that specifically lists some items that are on the list of items that would pay sales tax and removes grain bins and fencing materials from that list, and that would you'll find on line 2.1 of the bill. Part of the reason for this is there's, you know, with the case of a lot of our taxes in Minnesota, there's a lot of confusion. And so with the grain bins, I had a small business back in Chippewa County that sold entire grain handling systems, which included the bins, grain handling equipment, and dryers, and after an audit, he found out he owed some back sales tax on the portion of the total package that was grain bins. And so for simplification, that's one of the reasons for the bills. Also, as far as fencing material goes, fencing that's used for farm deer and elk is already exempt, so it's make things more uniform there. And also, at a time when we're looking for jobs, the sales tax exemption on some of these things, especially the grain bins, could result in some farmers making the purchase who otherwise might not have, and create some jobs there too. The bill becomes effective July 1st, 2011, and Mr. Chairman, I do have one testifier.
Okay, if you could please introduce yourself for the record and who you represent.
Yep. Mr. Chairman, I'm Gary Wordish. I'm Vice President of Minnesota Farmers Union.
Okay, Harry, and then your last name is spelled?
Gary.
Oh, Gary, I'm sorry. Gary. Last name spelled?
Wordish, W-E-R-T-I-S-H.
Thank you, sir. Please present your testimony.
I got to say, I've been called a lot of things, but I haven't been called Harry yet. But
I haven't either lately.
Interesting time to come after that last discussion, but I'm here today to speak in favor of the bill. As Lyle said, it would there's a lot of confusion out there now on some of these issues. And grain bins, the advantage it would provide a little incentive for the farmer to invest in his farm, into his operation, which ultimately would allow him to do a bit more flexibility in doing his marketing, which if he can do a better job doing his marketing of his grains, ultimately raises his income, and which raises his income to pay more income tax to the state. You know, put him in a better income bracket, which is a benefit to everybody. The fencing materials be the same thing. You know, it would provide a little incentive to provide young farmers to get into farming or maybe expand their farming operations. Also, it allow more livestock out on the landscape with more grazing, which would do a couple things. Spreads the livestock out. It reduces the soil erosion and water runoff. So it, you know, would be a benefit to the state that way too. But ultimately, both of it, you know, just little incentives that we can provide, you know, help the farmers and provide more jobs and providing, you know, more buying supplies from our local dealers and stuff like that, which ultimately helps the state. I guess that's all.
Thank you. Representative Biskins?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Coonan. I want to thank you for bringing forward this bill, which provides for a little less confiscation from the state of Minnesota. I do appreciate that. I know you know, there was a recommendation that you think of how this will be paid for. Before you answer that, Mr. Chairman, how much money did the state of Minnesota spend out of its general fund last biennium?
I believe it's about $30
billion. And, Mr. Chairman, how much money is the state projected to bring in this coming biennium?
I believe about $32 billion. I'd really like to raise those revenues.
Well, Mr. Well, Mr. Chairman, I think there's the answer to your question, Representative Coonan. And, Mr. Chairman, I don't envy you and House leadership the arduous task of how to spend an additional $2 billion.
Representative Biskins, we'll get her spent. any question? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Coonan, I'm looking on the fiscal note, and it says that the estimate includes non-livestock fencing. Can you give me a better idea of what we're talking about here? What would that cover?
Representative Coonan?
You know, in past discussions, there's been some concern about that. And, you know, first of all, these exemptions were set up for production of things that would eventually end up in retail sales, so you don't get the piling on of sales tax on top of sales tax, that type of thing. And, you know, what kind of fencing could be non-livestock fencing? That's a good question. There's many uses for fences beyond livestock. And should that be eligible for sales tax exemption or not? Now, what you're reading, I'm assuming, is off the revenue note, and I guess you'd have to ask the department what they were talking about there. I'm not really sure. I did read what you read there, but I'm not real sure what they included with that.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't know if our staff here know what's all included in that. Does that include, like, household fencing around your yard, or is it because it's in the ag section of law, is it just limited to that, and is it on a farmstead that you are allowed to fence around your yard there? I don't know, does this include metro fencing, does this include just fencing around homesteads in an ag, on a farm property? Do you have any idea?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, no, this would not apply to household, you know, personal fencing, because if you read the law, it relates to equipment used principally in agricultural production. I'm not sure. I think basically it relates to the technical definition of what's livestock and the animals that are not livestock, that in some cases these farmers would be purchasing fencing for poultry.
Ms.
Pat
Dalton
tells me poultry is
thank
not
you
livestock,
for your poultry.
So it's largely chicken fence.
Okay.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I learned many things in this committee.
We do, every day. Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and also along the lines of education. I just had a question. I know, I have a proposal, and we look at various things with regards to capital equipment for various types of businesses, and Minnesota right now has a rebate program for sales taxes on a lot of those things. And I was wondering if some of the farm equipment and various exemptions that currently exist, is that under a similar rebate program, or those are direct sales tax exemption?
Mr. Mike.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, this is an upfront exemption, and so it is not an instance where the purchaser has to apply for a refund.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. With that, Representative Coonan moves that House File 18 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Remember, members, this is not a committee. This is an adventure. Good government all the time. We are adjourned.